from the Hill Country of Texas, this is One Radio Network.
Hello?
Mr. Haley?
Yes.
This is Patrick Timpone.
How are you?
I'm good, sir. We're live here on One Radio Network. How were things? Were you in Kentucky?
Well, we had a lot of ice. A lot of people are without electricity, and roads are terrible for a while, but they're better now. It's improving.
Uh-huh. Did you go to work today?
Yes, I did.
And you are a professor of chemistry and biochemistry department at University of Kentucky?
That's where I was. I'm a professor emeritus now. I've retired as of this last July.
So now you can just stay home and do nothing?
No, I can't do that. I have a small biotech company that I'm running, developing some products. And we've had that company for a long, long time, though.
So that's the product, one of the products we're going to talk about tonight, which is that OSR, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me, give folks an idea of what you've been doing. Now, you did you've done massive amount of research, Mr. Haley, in Alzheimer's and mercury and the whole effects of heavy metals on the health, haven't you?
Yes, and I think if there's a take-home lesson that the folks ought to get tonight is that, in my opinion, one of the major failings of American medicine, modern American medicine, is the failure to appreciate and understand the severe medical problems that are caused in the general population by low-level or chronic heavy metal toxicity. That includes mercury, lead, arsenic, cadmium, and many other metals that are around. I think our modern medicine just doesn't appreciate that. And yet when you find people who are chronically ill and they go to certain enlightened physicians and they have their body fluids checked for heavy metals, you find out that they are incredibly toxic with multiple metals.
Uh-huh. Where is the we know about the mercury probably from the air and, you know, the fish and God knows where, but where does the lead come from? How do we get lead into our body?
Well, the bottom line is we don't know.
Oh, we don't know.
All the sources. You don't know all the sources of mercury. I mean, just in the last 2 days, the reports are out, publications showing that products that contain high fructose corn syrup are very high in mercury. Syrup is loaded with, not loaded, but I mean it's a consistent source of mercury exposure. And if you're a person that's say someone who uses a lot of products that have a sweet tooth, you're very likely going to be more exposed to mercury than somebody who doesn't eat products that contain high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, I wonder how the mercury gets into the corn.
Well, it's a product they use in making the corn.
Oh, they're making it.
They use a caustic soda, and some of that is made from plants that use mercury in the concentration or production of caustic soda.
Oh,
so
I see.
There is a line back to where it may come from. Although right now, none of us know. I mean, I haven't got any data on that. I can just only read what's in the report.
Yeah, we were reading the report earlier when they said, Mr. Haley, like 50% of the products they tested were high in mercury with the high fructose corn syrup.
Yes.
And that's everywhere, that stuff, isn't it?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, you look on any candy bar, any sweet product, they've replaced sugar, sugar beet sugar and cane sugar with high fructose corn syrup over the years. And so many of the products that used to be free of mercury and contain only, straight sugar, sucrose from sugar beets, now have the high fructose corn syrup as a sweetener, and they contain mercury.
Now, you've done quite a bit of research on Alzheimer's, correct?
Yes, that's how I got into this area. For many years, I was highly funded by NIH and developed a technique called nucleotide photofendi labeling, which means nothing.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah.
Easy for you to say, Mr. Early.
Right, but it means nothing to these folks. But it's an elegant, high-quality research technique that's in use even today and has been used for years now since then. But what I found, and the idea to make to get this down to the level of a layman, is you could use my technique and take a normal tissue and a diseased tissue, and you can compare the enzymes in those tissues to see if any had gone abnormal, and these are the enzymes that utilize energy. And I did that with several of them, and one of them I did it with was a normal brain versus Alzheimer's disease brain.
Uh-huh.
And in that process, we found, you know, three obvious proteins that were almost totally inhibited or destroyed in the Alzheimer's disease brain compared to the normal brain. And nobody disagrees with my finding. They all say I'm very correct on that. There's been a lot of data since that I published that saying, you know, I'm correct. But where I got off of the track with organized medicine or organized research was when I started looking for the cause of this, because Alzheimer's is not a directly inherited disease. I mean, they studied 500 identical twins from World War II, and while there's a genetic susceptibility that runs in families, it's not directly inherited, meaning that there's probably a toxicant that, you know, this person is susceptible to that makes him become demented.
Something that kicks it off, so to speak.
Right, a trigger. And
yeah.
When I started looking for things to cause that trigger, I studied all the heavy metals to start with because at that time they thought it would be aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that mercury, and only mercury, can mimic the biochemical abnormalities when you add it to a normal brain that are seen also in the AD brain.
Wow.
And so I published a paper saying that mercury would exacerbate the situation of anyone who is susceptible to being becoming demented with the Alzheimer's type dementia, and it might even be causal. You know, more research was needed at that time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have thought that I had called somebody a bad name. I mean, the response from organized medicine and from especially the dental associations.
Oh, they must have gone crazy.
Well, they were very nasty about it.
And what year was that?
That would be about 1988, 89.
Oh, wow, way back. Mm-hmm. And what did they try to discredit you then?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there's been quite a bit of that, but they haven't succeeded because other people have repeated my research. I'm very careful. I mean, I make no claims to being brilliant or anything like that, but
right.
I absolutely know I'm an extremely careful scientist. I know the problems that come up when you publish something that's wrong, and I've not had to retract anything I've ever published, and no one has published anything saying I'm wrong. They've made statements saying they don't believe my theories, but they never come up and say, he did this experiment wrong, and the results are wrong.
Wow.
So, you know, in what it comes down to is that American medicine through the vaccine exposure, through thimerosal and mercury-based preservatives, and the American Dental Association, through the use of amalgam fillings, or what they call silver fillings, you know, has covered up the exposure to Americans that come through medicine and dentistry for a long time, and they don't want us to know about it because, you know, at some point in time, people are going to realize this is the cause of many of their problems.
So it'd be difficult for them to ever admit it, unless they had a blanket kind of, what do you call it?
Immunity.
Immunity, right. Going forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what it would take, probably an act of Congress or something.
Otherwise, I don't think some of them would ever admit it.
Oh, and just because the ego, huh?
Well, look at it this way. In 1976, the U.S. Congress told the Food and Drug Administration to classify into class 1, 2, or 3, depending upon the safety level, any implant that was placed in the human body.
Hmm.
And the FDA did that, except for one implant, and that implant was dental amalgams. And they the Food and Drug Administration, steadfastly refused to classify or study dental amalgams with regard to their safety until, and they haven't classified it as of today. And it's the only product, and the main reason is because the FDA didn't want it classified, because you can't take something that's 50% mercury, that releases mercury vapor on a regular minute-by-minute basis, more if you chew, more if you drink hot fluids, more if you have gold in your mouth. There's no way you could classify amalgams as safe. And so the only way they could get by with using them was not to classify them at all. And this last year, and I know I wrote the affidavits, two of them, for the lawsuit, Charlie Brown, an attorney in Washington, D.C., who represents Consumers Dental Choice, along with the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology. This is a group of dentists who fight against the use of dental amalgams, wanting at least people to be told that there's mercury in the amalgams, supported a lawsuit, and we took them to court, and the Department of Justice lawyers tried to defend the FDA, saying that they were right in not classifying them. And the judge, in a matter of record, told them that they represented the worst of American government and that they had not classified amalgams in spite of all of the information that had been given to them and the data, et cetera. And so this July, the FDA will have to classify amalgams. That's the date she set, or they accepted, for classifying amalgam fillings when they should have been classified in 1976.
And then what will the classification, Mr. Haley, do to the whole amalgam fillings? Will they'll go away pretty quickly then?
Well, they're going away pretty quickly right now because the American public,
they know, right?
We've made them aware of the fact that they're mercury, but it's the poor people, the kids in the inner city, and people in the country who don't really keep up with the literature, and they trust everything their dentist or doctor says.
Sure.
But something near 60% of dentists don't place amalgam fillings now. Dentists aren't bad people. Dentists have just been fed a line of erroneous data by the administrators of the American Dental Association. But what will happen is that they have to put the amalgams in class 1, 2, or 3. And class 1 items are materials that there is no known danger at all, and that would be totally safe. Class 2 would be where they're used, but there are restrictions. In other words, we think that they will probably, almost for certain, say you can't put amalgam fillings in young children or women who are going to be of childbearing age. But it's okay to put it in men and older boys. That was the way they seemed to be going early on. I think I may have changed their mind with regard to that. Or if they put it in class 3, you can only use it in a kind of a medical emergency, and that would be the death of amalgam fillings. They would go where they should go, and that's not be used. Because the public listening have to understand, any amalgam that's taken out of the mouth, any amalgam that you use to put in the mouth that you can't get in the mouth and you have as waste when the dentist does a filling, has to be removed from the dentist's office as a toxic waste. You can't throw it in the trash and you can't put it in a landfill. And yet it's considered safe in the human mouth. I mean, so it's that kind of idiocy that drives me crazy.
And your research, you're conclusively proves then that the mercury connection with Alzheimer's?
In my mind, yes.
Uh-huh.
It would be at least an exacerbating factor. I mean, for example, the research done by many other people, not myself, where they use cadavers and they measure the amount of mercury in the different body organs shows that the brain level, and as well as the liver, kidney, etc., levels of mercury in a cadaver, a dead person, is directly correlated to how many amalgam fillings they have, not if they eat fish or live near a coal-fired power plant, but how many amalgams do you have? Because, you know, you have something that's 50% mercury releasing mercury vapors that's just inches from your brain. And those vapors have been shown to be absorbed by the body at the rate of 80%. And those vapors, mercury vapors, can penetrate, you know, the nasal mucosa, they can penetrate the blood-brain barrier, they go directly into the brain where they get oxidized, and once the mercury's in the brain and reacted, it has a half-life of somewhere between 17 and 27 years. So it builds up slowly in your brain, and as you age, you lose the ability to protect your brain from this toxic mercury.
Talking with Boyd Haley, and he's professor emeritus at University of Kentucky. Now he has his own biotech company, and we'll kick around a little bit this new product that I've been taking for a couple of weeks and was turned on to, and then we'll have you back, if you would, Mr. Haley, sometime. We'll really, really dig in for an hour or so of just uninterrupted and learn more about the mercury thing. But I'm too intrigued to let you go yet, or to move on yet. So what other things that we call diseases do you suppose are linked to mercury?
Well, first of all, people have to understand that many diseases, I mean, it would be hard to name one that's not associated with, an element in the biochemistry of the body, which we call oxidative stress or low glutathione levels.
Oxidative stress.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that you're producing too many hydroxy free radicals. And these are chemicals that are naturally produced in the body, but you start producing way too many of them when you're toxic, and these radicals destroy the nearby tissue. I mean, they're the cause of wrinkles. When you have a red rash on your body, these molecules are the ones that cause that red rash.
These are called free radicals?
Free radicals, yes.
And these are caused because there are heavy metals in the body?
Well, they're caused by a lot of things.
Hmm.
They're caused by an infection. Your body will overproduce these in fighting a certain infection. All metals, I mean, to make free radicals, you almost have to have a metal involved in the reaction. And we know that oxidative stress in animals and other model systems is definitely caused by an excess of heavy metals, mercury, lead, even excess iron, cadmium from cigarette smoke, etc. So it's quite a complex chemical system, and hard to explain on the phone. But what we know is that most diseases, most illnesses, arthritis, cancer, Parkinson's, MS, ALS, Alzheimer's disease, autism, all of these diseases have associated with them a low level of a molecule called glutathione, which is the major free radical fighting molecule in the body.
And this is the body's natural
propensity
to fight these free radicals.
Yes.
And we know that in these diseases or health challenges, there's less glutathione.
Yes.
And
there are other things that can cause it. For example, it's well known that, you know, we have over 200,000 cases of Tylenol overdose toxicity reported in the United States every year, and around approximately 500 deaths. Tylenol is used to relieve pain, and yet Tylenol is known to decrease the glutathione levels in the body dramatically.
It does.
And if you take too much of it,
wow!
Like if you go on a drunk and you wake up the next morning and you throw down a lot of Tylenol, you're probably going to end up in the hospital with liver failure because the glutathione is being used to get the Tylenol toxic, which it perceives as a toxin, out of the body. And so there are a lot of things that can cause us to go into oxidative stress. And one of those, of course, as I talked, is the heavy metals, which, you know, that's well known in research. That's not a finding done by me. But so if you walk along with, if you have two people and one of them's got a mouthful of amalgams carrying a heavy mercury body burden and the other is not, they both go out and get drunk, wake up the next morning and take Tylenol to relieve their headache. The person with the overdose of or the load of heavy metals or mercury is going to go down faster than the one who doesn't have it. So this is not a simple system. A person's got to look at their whole lifestyle to put this in perspective. But there are a lot of things that put us into oxidative stress, and when we, you know, take the straw that breaks the camel's back and get overdone, then our cells start dying.
Oh. Now, there are people, there's some pretty nice glutathione available on the market now, fairly cost-effective. Do they work?
For the most part, they can help, but no, they don't. They don't seem to do that good. People have tried. I mean, it's been a goal, and that's the reason there's so many on the market, so many people have tried. And what you have to do, and if you're going to elevate these things, the physicians need to do on the patient a blood glutathione level. You know, it's a $33 test, you know, sent off to a clinic, and that comes back and tells you where your glutathione levels approximately are in your body. And if they're low, then you take some of these products. Then after a month or 2 months, you measure your glutathione level again and see if they work, because some of these products may work for one person and not another. Because a lot of it depends upon the level of heavy metal toxicity you have in your body. The level of how often do you take Tylenol or aspirin or something else? I mean, I don't know what all drugs could cause oxidative stress. So it's very much a lifestyle thing, and I don't think we totally understand it, and I certainly couldn't give complete information on that. But what we have to do is, and we do have this, we have two things that we can measure in the body to tell us how well we're doing. First is our blood glutathione levels, a simple, easy blood test. And the second is a urinary porphyrin profile test that will tell us, you know, if we do have heavy metal toxicity and what heavy metal we're toxic with in the body. That's a proven scientific test.
That's like what they call a mercury challenge?
No. Urinary porphyrin profile, you just send in urine and they measure the porphyrins are a series of compounds that end up making heme.
Porphyrins.
porphyrins, P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-I-N-S. Huh. And there's about five of them that you can measure in the urine. And if you, they understand, lead bark blocks at one site, mercury blocks at another, and what happens, depending on which porphyrin goes up, you have an indication of which metal you're toxic to.
Wow.
And as, for example, with autistic children, the bulk of them seem to be toxic with mercury.
And how could all of us today take one of these tests? These
sure.
How do you do that?
Go to your doctor, tell him you want to, you think you're concerned about the toxicity profile in your body, and you would like to have a urinary mercury profile done.
Urinary mercury profile.
No, urinary porphyrin profile. Oh. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Urinary porphyrin profile.
Yeah, because it can tell you whether you're toxic with mercury, lead, arsenic, or PCBs, organic compounds, etc.
Wow.
Because there's four different sites that seem to be inhibited, and I didn't develop the test. I don't have any money in it. It's mm-hmm. one that's been used, extensively.
And you can just send in urine, and they can test it.
That's right.
Wow. Now, when we do a hair analysis, how do we know if it shows up high mercury, if it's in the body or the body is excreting it?
You don't really know.
You don't know.
No, I mean, you can make a guess. I would say the best thing about hair analysis, if mercury's in your hair, you know you got it in your body. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Right.
But if you have a mouthful of amalgams, or you know you've been exposed to mercury and there's no mercury in your hair,
then you know that you're not getting rid of it.
You know you're not getting rid of it. Your person is probably retaining it.
Yeah. So that's why the hair analysis are just a tool when you have other things that somebody who's skilled, they can kind of give them more information.
Right. But you have to go to a physician that, you know, goes to meetings and talks to people that do this kind of research to understand. Because many people will say, well, if you don't have mercury in your hair, it means you have none in your body.
Sure. Well, there are healthcare practitioners out there now that are up on this stuff.
Yes, there are. Quite, and they're getting more and more up on it.
Yeah. My name is Patrick Timpone. We're talking with Boyd Haley, who's Professor Emeritus at the University of Kentucky. You were there for how long, sir, doing your research?
Well, I've been doing this type of research since about 1974. But I was first at the at Yale University, then the University of Wyoming, and then I came to Kentucky in 1985.
1974, wow. Now, what about things like, how would one get copper out of their body if they had high copper in their hair analysis?
Well, there are certain chelators that would work on that, but I'm not certain which ones would be the best. I know some people recommend EDTA, et cetera. And I'm not a person that is expert at the treatment of different metals that are being removed from the human body by chelators. As a matter of fact, for a long time, I was not very much in favor of the use of certain chelators because I knew they were toxic. And the real problem we have is we don't have good chelators for the different metals.
Mm.
The chelators that are commonly used today, for example, for mercury, were invented in 1930s by the Russians and Germans, and since that date, we haven't come up with a better way of getting mercury out. We haven't even tried.
I think you know of Dr. David Kennedy.
Well, yes, I know David very well.
He was on the show not long ago, I think last week, and I think he mentioned EDTA, and I had asked him about EDTA for getting out mercury, and he said it's possible, but it has some downsides because it could possibly do something weird with lead or something, if I recall.
Yes, well, EDTA can, it's been shown to move lead across the blood-brain barrier in rat brains with the rats.
Yeah, well, that's not good.
Yeah, so we need a lot of research to be done on the different chelators to see which ones work effectively.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, this product that I want to mention here, I was at a dentist office a couple of weeks ago in Houston, and we got to talking to Dr. Wilkie. Do you know him?
I know who he is, yes.
Yeah, and so he said, well, you got to try this product, you know, and I'm just a wild guy. I'll just try anything, you know what I mean, Boyd? So he said, this is really good stuff. I mean, I know Boyd Haley, and this is good stuff. And he said, it's oxidative stress, and he was explaining. So right away, I just, of course, bought some. You know, I couldn't leave the building without buying some. And I've been taking it, and I like the way I'm feeling, but, you know, I take a lot of different things, but just for a couple of weeks. What is this product that you've developed? What exactly, what is it?
Well, the one thing I can tell you It is a compound I designed to address the issue of oxidative stress in the human body, and in pets also. And we have had it tested by FDA-certified laboratories, you know, for toxicology, how toxic is it?
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't give enough to a rat to make him have a toxic effect.
Well, that's good.
So, I mean, the rats took 5 grams per kilogram body weight per day, and then they did a 28-day study where they took a gram per kilogram body weight. That's over 1,000 times what we would recommend for a human to take.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of 28 days, the rats were sacrificed, and all the organs were looked at individually, weighed, microscopy, histology done on them, and there was no sign of toxicity in the animal studies. And after that, I took it for 6 straight months myself while we were preparing this data for a submission to the FDA as for a new dietary ingredient as an antioxidant. And I've taken it now for 2 years. And what it does, and that we can say, I mean, because you have to be very careful. I mean, people like me are not allowed to make any unfounded claims,
sure,
according
sure.
to the FDA regulation, which I agree with that regulation. We can say the compound's without toxicity. We have shown that it is an avid scavenger of hydroxy-free radicals, the compounds that, you know, that make you sick when you have heavy metal or any kind of toxic effect going on in your body, and that it helps maintain a healthy glutathione level in the body. The glutathione, I mean, it does that because since it scavenges hydroxy radicals, the glutathione is salvaged and is not used up, and so it's built up, and then you can use the glutathione to remove other toxins. Now, people have to understand organic-type toxins like benzene, PCBs, etc., many of them are removed by being attached to glutathione by an enzyme called glutathione S transferase, and that's how you detox these organics out of your body.
Hmm.
But you can't do that if you don't have enough glutathione.
And so the OSR, you're suggesting that we'll get rid of these free radicals so the glutathione can do its thing.
Yeah, so you can build up and
so you can build up enough glutathione to get rid of this stuff when it comes in.
Right, and in a natural, healthy person, most mercury removed from the body is removed as a complex with glutathione. So what this compound that I've developed is doing is it's increasing the natural level of this compound or helping you maintain a healthy level of this compound in the body that allows you to naturally detoxify yourself, which is what glutathione does.
Hmm. And I noticed that the dose that I'm taking, like, is just tiny. It's just this little bitty spoon. I'd be taking 2 of those a day. Is that right?
Well,
I mean one little scoop of that twice a day.
Yeah, and what I would say is we don't know the best level. We know that the level we recommend is effective, but you may get better faster if you took more, and you may not have, and you may get better just as fast if you took a little bit less. But the level you take is totally safe. There's no toxic effects associated with it. And
would we not feel the mercury coming out or any kind of a healing response of that?
Well, you could, but you know, it depends on how sick you are and what problems you have. I would not, when I took it, I didn't feel anything except you know, all of a sudden I have a better sense of well-being. But I mean, that is something that's very difficult to measure, and you know, and in my position I have to carefully separate what I think from what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
sure, sure.
I've got to be very, very.
No, I appreciate that.
The only thing I can say is, you know, that it shouldn't be. No one should listen to me about this. They should listen to the physicians who are treating patients and measuring their blood chemistries. I mean, their glutathione levels, their porphyrin profiles. You know, their blood chemistries that indicate whether or not they're becoming better or not. And they should listen to the different people like you that take it after a period of time.
So this porphyrin test would definitely tell you how much mercury you have in there?
No, it just tells you whether your body is mercury toxic or not.
Oh, toxic.
See, this study was done on, you know, several hundred American dentists by Dr. James Woods at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And 85% of the American dentists were shown to have what we would call an abnormal urinary porphyrin profile, indicating they were mercury toxic.
Wow.
And 15% of that 85% appeared to be severely affected. And that may be because of a genetic, and they speculated that was because of a genetic susceptibility in their what they call their CPOX.
Yeah, there seems to be a genetic component. There was a test that, Mr. Haley, that that you could take, I think, from People's Pharmacy in the Austin area. I live outside of Austin, and it was some kind of a genetic thing. And one of the markers was your ability to your body to make enough glutathione.
Right.
And does that sound right?
Yes. Yes, I think. I absolutely, because you know it takes energy to make glutathione in the body.
I see.
And a lot of the people that are susceptible to autoimmune disease. And in particular, right now the big splash is on autism.
Mm-hmm.
They have they call it a mitochondrial dysfunction, but what it is, it's a mitochondrial susceptibility to heavy metal toxicity, and so these people at very low levels of heavy metals lose the ability to make heme from the porphyrin we talked about, as well as the ability to make glutathione. I mean, autistic children, if you look at them, they're very pale. They have a in my opinion, a very observable lack of heme, or the hemoglobin in the red cells. That's where the porphyrin leads to. They also have been shown, without a doubt, to have very, very low glutathione levels on the average. And so this makes them, so this may be caused by an exposure to a heavy metal toxin or another toxin, or it may be that these people with this genetic susceptibility are just more susceptible to the heavy metals toxins and other toxins they are exposed to.
Have you been able to, do these porphyrin tests on people and then to take this OSR and then retake the test and see results?
Yes, we have.
And they're positive?
I'm not allowed to say.
Oh, you're not allowed to say?
Other people can say. The physicians who did it can tell you. I'd suggest you go ask some of them.
No kidding. You can't say.
If I did, then I'm speculating on a medical drug effect of this kind.
I'll be darned. That's pretty wild.
So I'm not the...
So I can go to one of my docs that I have a good relationship with, and they can get one of these porphyrin tests.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like to do one now and then take your product for, take your product.
It's what I recommended from the very start when the compound was available, because, I feel so sorry for the American public. Because of the nature and the restrictions on our medicine, that there's so many things are sold in them, like a pig and a poke.
Yes, sir.
And if somebody comes up to you and says, we have a magic compound or formula X that you take and it'll solve all your problems, the typical snake oil approach, you ask them, what blood test can I take to show that your compound's working? And so this is what I've developed, and I looked at it first. I mean, I can tell you, I said, here are the things that we need to look at to see if what I've developed is worth anything. And if it weren't, I can assure you, I have a certain level of ethics. I would not be putting this out if I didn't think it was good for people.
And that's pretty cool.
So you just tell people, don't believe me. I mean, don't ever believe the exaggerated claims of the supplier.
Get the test.
And resolve right away whether or not. But not only does it do good, does it do any harm? And I can tell you, we've done the testing on OSR with people, and it does not cause, we have not been able to define anything where it does any harm.
Do you have any idea of how long it takes taking the product before stuff starts coming out?
I have an idea, yes. But I mean, I haven't measured anything going out. All we've measured is the effect on glutathione levels. And you get glutathione levels to a healthy level.
On glutathione.
That, and that happens within, people waited a month. They took their glutathione levels, waited a month, took it again, and to see if it would make their levels more healthy, and did it help them with, and this is along with other ideas, other therapies also, and not therapies, but good nutrition. I mean, nothing out there will make a person healthy if they don't have a good diet.
Yeah.
If they're not taking, to make glutathione, you have to have cysteine in your diet. If you don't have cysteine in your diet, you can take any anything that's on the market anywhere, and it's not going to help you.
And where does cysteine come from?
Oh, it comes from, things like eggs, et cetera. Yellow, it's the sulfur-smelling amino acid.
Sulfur?
Yeah, it's an amino acid that puts sulfhydryl groups in proteins. It's very critical, and it's the one that's destroyed the quickest on cooking, on processing.
Yep.
So many people walk around with low cysteine levels because we eat too much processed food.
Yeah, sulfur is a kind of a sneaky thing. That's one of the big things that the raw food people say, that, you know, cooking destroys the sulfur.
It does. You know, it's the easiest amino acid to oxidize biochemically. Or
So if one was eating, so you could eat maybe raw egg yolk would be good, maybe.
Well, I mean, you know? I would recommend, I mean, eating eggs that are not hard cooked, but just, you know, soft, easy, over easy eggs, et cetera, would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Or poached eggs, or and there are other things, a lot of nuts, et cetera, have.
Oh, good old nuts. We like nuts around here.
Yeah.
They have that cysteine, and that helps to make the glutathione.
Yeah.
So then if one were taking a good glutathione in your product too, then that might be good. It helps keep it up there?
That would be something I would suggest.
Why not?
Mainly, our compound is a hydroxy radical scavenger, and that's what consumes the glutathione you do make.
Scavenger's a hydroxy radical thing.
Free radicals, right.
Mm-hmm. And it's just a little powder, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a powder.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't taste bad.
No.
It doesn't taste good. I mean, you would...
Yeah, it's kind of got a little, you know, the only kind of challenge I think there is with it, it's hard for it to mix it in water. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Don't mix it in water. Mix it in things like peanut butter or applesauce or apple butter.
Just put it in anything.
Yeah, and the same thing that you can kind of, because it'll cover the flavor, and your body will absorb it. It doesn't have to dissolve for your body. It's just like, you know, the fat on a piece of pork chop. You know, you can absorb that fat. A lot of us show that. And so this is the same thing, you know, it gets into the...
So just get it in your body.
Yeah. Your intestines will take it up.
Okay, so I mean, I could just take my little scoop and just put it right in on the tongue or something. It's cool.
That's the way I do it.
That's what you do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And then they can only get this through some type of healthcare practitioner, correct?
Right. We think that, you know, anything new like this, we want to make sure people are working with a good medical provider. And so we only sell it to people that have... you know, substantial medical training.
Like chiropractors or even certified clinical nutritionists, something like that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they could just ask for OSR, right?
Yeah, just to tell them they want to try that. And
So how would they find you?
It's a dietary ingredient. If they want to find out how to get the compound, they can go to www.CTIScience.com.
Okay, so they can, their healthcare person can go to CTIScience.
.com. And we'll send them information. But we don't want to give it to people who who aren't trained to know how to, because you see, there are certain people out there that are sulfur sensitive. They get sick even eating foods with sulfur in it.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. I mean, there's some people that can't take glutathione without getting sick. You know, and I don't know why that is, but I've been told it exists, and so we're just trying to be very, very cautious. And a lot of times in the process of getting healthier, people sometimes will go through a period where they'll feel uncomfortable, but that uncomfortable feeling is part of the healing
process. Yeah, that's just a healing thing going on. Something's trying to get out, right? Now, do we think the heavy metals exit from, would it be from in the urine or... the feces, do we know?
No. If indeed, you know, heavy metals are being excreted by a healthy body, it goes out through the fecal route.
Uh-huh.
Over 90% of the mercury that leaves the body of a healthy person goes out bound to glutathione in the fecal route through the biliary transport system. Less than 10% goes out through the urine, hair, and other species, and usually that's bound to something like cysteine. I mean, if you're heavy metal toxic, that's one reason why you might be short of cysteine. If you have mercury and cysteine floating around your bloodstream together, the mercury is going to react to that cysteine, and that cysteine is not going to be functional.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be removed by the kidney,
mm-hmm.
and that'll keep your cysteine levels low. It also gets rid of some of the mercury, but it can also be, you know, relatively toxic, cause kidney problems as the mercury gets. As the mercury cysteine complex goes through the kidney may pick off that mercury with a sulfur group in the kidney, and then that part of that molecule is impaired in the kidney. So there's a real problem with that. So
boy, that mercury is rough stuff, isn't it?
It's very dangerous.
Really bad stuff, man. Can't believe they've been using it for that long. And then do we have any idea? What would you? Can you make a guesstimate, Boyd Haley, of how challenging it is just breathing the air from the mercury, the coal-fired plants, which is the primary source for energy in this country?
Well, it's something.
Do we have any way of knowing?
Well, we know how much mercury is released by the coal.
It's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot, but it pales. But see, it's dispersed throughout the entire, atmosphere.
Right.
And so the amount you take in by breathing it is a lot less than, say, from the few grams you have in your mouth from a dental amalgam.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
So you think the amalgams are now...
There's no doubt about that.
That's the key source.
The science has shown that. I mean, in studies done everywhere where people eat a lot of fish, et cetera, they don't have higher body levels of mercury than, say, the average American. And if you take an American, like I say, all the studies done, not only in the United States, in Los Angeles, but in Turkey and other places, but they've looked at cadavers and they looked at the level of mercury in their bodies, it corresponds to the number of amalgam fillings they have, or silver fillings they have, as the ADA likes to call them. It doesn't depend on whether they eat fish or not. But see, the mercury in fish has already reacted with protective compounds in the fish. Otherwise, it would kill the fish.
Hmm.
If you take goldfish in a bowl and you add mercury to the goldfish, at a certain level, they're dead in 20 minutes because they haven't taken it in slowly. And yet they won't have the level that is found, say, in a lot of the fish we eat. But when it goes into the fish in the ocean, we have things like selenium. The ocean has a lot of selenium in it. And so the fish tie up the mercury with the selenium, so you end up with mercury selenide. This is stored in the fish's body, but it's not bioavailable anymore. I mean, it's totally neutralized because of its complex with selenium. And so when you eat the fish, even though you eat so many micrograms of mercury, that mercury is not reactive.
Hmm.
So it goes straight through your body, and you defecate it out, primarily on the day or the day after you eat it. Whereas amalgam mercury is a vapor form, it's unreacted mercury, hasn't reacted with any protective compounds in any mammal yet, and so when it comes out, it's absorbed by your body's fat tissues, passes the blood-brain barrier, and then slowly gets oxidized, and 80% of it's retained by the body, whereas the mercury in fish, very little of it is retained by the body.
It's interesting. So when one gets their mercury fillings out, and say if we didn't take anything like OSR or glutathione, and the body was, say, really healthy, which is unusual, but just say the glutathione levels are way up there, do you have any idea how long it takes for the body to get rid of this stuff that's in the body after the fillings come out?
In everything but the brain, it would go out relatively fast, probably within a few months.
Really?
Yeah. Now, the brain is a different problem because there, and we don't know the answer there because no one's done that experiment there. And no one studied that person you're talking about because they kind of resent having a biopsy done on their brain.
Yeah. I'm trying to cut down on that myself.
Right.
So we just don't know. But it's a lot harder. Now, will your product and the glutathione and help to get, do you think it'll help get it out of the brain?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. That would be a big speculation on my part.
Mm-hmm.
But I
mm-hmm.
think if you get the bodies, it works this way. If you get the body's total glutathione levels up to a healthy level.
And
keep them up every day, make sure that they don't get depleted, then your body will slowly get rid of the heavy metals in your body.
Mm.
And I know because they've done a mercury challenge test on me, with DMPS, and they could find no heavy metals, no increase in heavy metals that was significant in me after taking.
Have you done the porphyrin test now?
No, I haven't done that.
Oh, you haven't done that?
I I haven't had any mercury in my body for 15 years. I think it'd be a waste of money. I mean, I'm surely not mercury toxic because I don't have any. I make sure I don't get exposed to mercury.
So the porphyrin thing, it does, but then it does lead and other things as well, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when they tested me, I was told that I had the lowest level of lead ever. That they ever saw in an adult male.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I've been taking OSR for a year, and I keep my glutathione levels are over 1,200. I think that's probably the reason.
Blood glutathione levels?
Pardon?
Your blood glutathione levels?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what's the average? What do they say is like good?
Well, they say the average, and I'm pulling numbers out, and I don't want to misquote, but I know they said it was 669 is a...
Is a good number?
Is a normal.
And you got 1,200...
But I'm not the only. A lot of people have pretty high. A lot of it depends on their diet and how healthy they are. But I think I'm not a good candidate for looking at somebody that's mercury toxic. But I would say that the point I wanted to make: if you keep yourself at a healthy glutathione level, you will slowly get the the heavy metals out of your body, because that's what glutathione does. And if they're retained in your body, it's because you've either been overdosed or you've been under oxidative stress and unable to get rid of them.
I see.
If you keep the mercury level low in your liver, your kidney, your muscle tissue, your skin, and everything else, then that mercury in your brain is going to come out faster, because there's going to be no pushback.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be going one direction. So it's going to come out faster than if you don't keep your body glutathione levels up. But I don't know that taking glutathione precursors would get it out of the brain faster. We just don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this has just been really fascinating. This is like going to smorgasbord talking to guys like you. And thanks so much for your time. And so, folks, if they want to try this, they can do the test at their healthcare practitioner, right? Called a porphyrin, how do you say it?
A urinary porphyrin profile.
A urinary porphyrin profile. And then they can see where they are, and then they can ask their healthcare person to try some of this, and then go to ctiscience.com and order some for them. Mm-hmm. And they have some fun, and then take a test 6 months later and just see how they do.
And I just want to make it clear, we make no claim that this cures any disease.
No, I understand.
It's just it's a free radical scavenger that we think, we suggest, and then the research backs us up on that. It helps you keep a healthy glutathione level.
Well, you've been very careful with that, Mr. Haley. Well, we will do it again and dig in some more to this, and I will put this talk with you also on our dental section, because people are really interested in the mercury, and we'll stick it right there. And thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a joy talking to you.
Nice talking to you, sir. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Boyd Haley. Know the Source on One Radio Network.